series of talks. The first speaker is Scott Morrison, and he will tell us on progress on fusion integrity.
Thank you. So I have a confession. I don't believe in higher categories. I mean, I do, I love higher categories. I mean, with Kevin, I wrote a whole paper giving yet another definition of them. But I don't know any examples. I mean, do any of you know of a 5 category? Do any of you know of a 17 category? I mean, if any of you told me a 17 category, I'm pretty sure that I can just search and replace and change 17 to 19, and I'll have a 19 category. Now, for the lower values of n, that's not really true. For 0, 1, 2, 3, and 4, I think they really are examples. There are examples of n categories in low dimensions that really intrinsically involve the geometry of the dimension. And those are the sorts of examples that I think are really interesting. And in some sense, this talk is all about examples. So usually when people say things like this, mathematicians don't feel very offended. I mean, we're doing something better than either physics or Stanford. But this talk is definitely Stanford. Okay? There's maybe not a whole lot of structure in what we know at this point about fusion categories. It is just kind of a mess of examples. But there are little bits that we're beginning to understand, and I want to show you my example. Okay, so why study fusion categories in the first place? Well, here are a few good reasons. As Sonia pointed out in her talk, a fusion category is a non-commutative finite group, in the sense that if you add the adjective symmetric to a fusion category, then by the wing, it's a representation. The representation category of a finite supergroup. So if you like finite groups, then maybe fusion categories are an interesting direction to analyze.
Do you really want to say non-commutative finite group? This is sort of the least striking statement you can make.
It's non-commutative in the sense of non-commutative geometry. Von Neumann algebra is a non-commutative measure space. It's the same theory.
Okay.
You've got to think about the representation category rather than the group for that to make any sense. Okay. Then in Chris's talk on Monday, he explained that fusion categories are exactly what you want to think about if you care about 2+1 dimensional local TFTs, at least with targets in tensor categories, the individualizable objects of the fusion categories. And then going back to where I started, not believing in higher categories. Fusion categories are the very first place where we can study higher categories. There's something higher about them, but they're just as easy as possible. Everything is as nice as we could possibly imagine. And if we want to make some progress on understanding what things look like, maybe this is a nice world to study. Okay, so what is a fusion category? Happily, a few people have already said this in talks earlier in the week, but I'll just say it again. Just a semi-simple tensor category. We're here, tensor means, as in Chris's talk, abelian and rigid vector spaces, monoidal and rigid, and importantly with only finitely many simple objects. Now, to make life easier, since I'm not really trying to understand all fusion categories, I'm just trying to understand examples for now, let's just make life easy in a few additional ways. Conjecturally, all fusion categories are pivotal. The double dual functor is equivalent to the identity. So let's just pretend that's the case. So whenever I say fusion category, maybe to make the statement true, you might have to put the words pivotal fusion category. And I'll also be happy a few points along the way to just say that we're only interested in unitary fusion categories as well. Okay. So let's start with an example. I guess one that's not a finite group, just to be very explicit. So here's the golden category. It's a very nice one. It's two simple objects. We can call iota and tau here. Objects in fusion categories have dimensions, and these ones have dimensions 1 in the golden ratio. And the Grothendieck ring is very simple. the tensor square of the tau object is just the trivial plus another copy of the tau. So in particular, that means we've got some map from tau tensor tau to tau. And so let's draw that map as a little trivalent vertex. It turns out that it makes sense to draw that as a trivalent vertex in the sense that it's rotationally symmetric. You take that map and twist it around, you really do get itself back, so it's reasonable to draw it as a trivalent vertex. And now, everything in the category is really generated by this morphism. That is, if you have any morphism in this category, say from the nth tensor power of tau to the mth tensor power of tau, we can represent that as some linear combination of planar trivalent graphs where there are m boundary points on the bottom of the graph and m boundary points on the top of the graph. And in fact, we can completely describe the category in terms of those linear combinations of planar trivalent graphs because there are just these three relations satisfied by those planar trivalent graphs. The circle can be removed for some value, and you can see a lollipop, you get zero. And then there's some relation that lets you change i's for h's in exchange for with the addition of some lower order terms. Okay, so this little diagrammatic description completely tells you what category you're looking at. There's nothing more to say. It's just the category of these diagrams, tensor products sticking in sideways compositions, stacking on top of each other. And this category, of course, comes from somewhere. It's the representations of UQSL2 or the tensor of unity, semi-simplified. But this is obviously a whole lot simpler. You just give this definition. You don't need to mention all the modules or anything like that. Okay. So there's an example. So what do fusion categories look like? Well, I mean, as I think you've probably guessed by now, I'm not really going to answer what do they look like in any reasonable sense. That I'm not going to tell you the structure theory of fusion categories or how you build them out of simple building blocks. We're just going to look at examples. But to begin with, the obvious examples of fusion categories are the representations of any finite group, or the semi-simplified representation theory of a UQG out of a Bethe unit. But there's a lot more out of the world of fusion categories besides examples coming from those two places and nearby places. And one of the kind of fun things is that we've discovered you might call them sporadic fusion categories, which have come up during attempts to classify small index subfactors. I'll come back to what subfactors have to do with the subject in just a second. But let me just mention the names of some of the examples. So here there's the Hagerup, the Seder Hagerup, and the extended Hagerup fusion categories. And I've drawn a little diagram to represent this. Since the diagram is longer and later, let me just briefly tell you what it means. That picture on the left of there, well, these pictures are principal graphs of these fusion categories. So here when we draw this graph, we mean that this vertex corresponds to the trivial object in the fusion category, and we've got some special chosen object which we're thinking of generating in the fusion category X there. And now the edges just tell you the tensor product multiplicities. So the fact that out of this vertex there's an edge back to 1, and an edge to X itself, and an edge to these guys, maybe P, Q, that's telling you that X, tensor X, is isomorphic to 1 plus X plus P plus Q. And then similarly here, you can work out what you find inside P tensor X by looking at all the neighbors of P in this graph. Okay, so it's just encoding a small piece of the fusion rules of the category that we get to draw. A nice little picture. And it's a convenient way of talking about which fusion category you're talking about. There's a unique fusion ring extending what you can read off that graph. And so, anyway, we'll come back to principal graphs later.
Does that mean the fusion rules are symmetric, or it means P tensor X and X tensor P might be something else?
I'm only telling you this graph is only encoding tensor on the right of something. What we might add is a little bit more information to this graph and say these two objects are dual to each other and everything else is solved dual. And once I add that information, you also know the tensor on the left. Okay. So, well, what are these examples that have come from subfactors to us good for? Well, they certainly constrain conjectures that you might make about fusion categories. An instance of that is this theorem here, that two of these categories, the first one and the last one there, can't be defined over any cyclotomic field, which is sort of an interesting observation, because all of the examples that were on the previous slide, representations of finite groups by Brouwer and quantum groups of roots of unity, sort of by obviousness, are defined over cyclotomic fields. Okay? But there are fusion categories out there that require you to go further afield. And this is the examples from subfactors. Hope you're learning some things. Okay. So these sporadic examples are going to turn up a few times in what follows in the talk, especially this first one, the fusion category coming from the hardware subfactor. So, what on earth do subfactors have to do with fusion categories anyway? Well, one thing is that while we're studying fusion categories, it seems sensible to study them up to merger equivalence. So, there's sort of, I think, two reasons to do this. One is that if you're interested in the TQFT that comes from a fusion category, the two and three dimensional part only sees the merger equivalence class of the fusion category. I mean, a merger equivalence gives you isomorphisms between the derived area vector spaces and so on. So that's one reason. But another reason is just that sometimes we discover some fusion category by some means, and then later we work out how to see its whole merger equivalence class, and then we realize that some other category in that merger equivalence class is related to something that we've seen before or somewhere else that was previously mysterious. And it often helps us organize things by knowing the merger equivalent categories. Okay. So again, merger equivalences were mentioned briefly in an earlier talk, so I'm not going to spend much time going on about what exactly it is, but it's a binomial category between the two fusion categories, C and D, with the property that the lean tensor products of this binomial category that's dual, in one case the category C, and that other way around the category. Okay, so once we've said that, we can explain what are the subfactors have to do with the subject. I'm going to not even say what a subfactor is, because in some sense this is almost a definition. First of all, given a finite depth subfactor, we obtain a merger equivalence between two fusion categories. You can look at all of the AA bimodules to A some monomial algebra, and I don't mean all of the AA bimodules, but I mean all of the AA bimodules that you can build using B in some kind of simple sense. So that's some fusion category. And you can also look at all the VB bimodules. Again, you can build using this inclusion. And that's some other fusion category. And then the collection of AB bimodules, it turns out, is a source of merger equivalence between those two fusion categories on that side. Now, this isn't just a source of examples of fusion categories and merger equivalences between them. It's universal. I mean, every time you have a merger equivalence between fusion categories, as long as everything is unitary, we have to put in unitary at this point, then it's that merger equivalence between unitary fusion categories is realized by some subfactor. Okay, so if you want to, you've always, this is sort of one way of realizing fusion categories and merger equivalences between as representations of something.
Can I take the identity merger equivalence?
And you can take the identity merger equivalence, and this is often a nice thing to do. Given a single fusion category, you get a subfactor in this way, by considering the identity merger equivalence. Yeah, we'll do that later in the talk.
Sorry, are all fusion categories of the type B mod B for a phenomenon?
I mean, in particular, that's a consequence of the fact that we can take the identity merger equivalence.
Sorry, I was wondering whether it was good.
Okay. So, given that at the moment, actually understanding all fusion categories is a completely ridiculous goal, we're just going to try and understand, we're going to try and give classifications of small fusion categories for the various senses of small. And so there are a few good ways, I think, to filter fusion categories by size, and these are the four that I'm going to talk about here today. So there's rank, just the number of simple objects in the category. There's the global dimension, which is the... that formula is wrong. It's the sum of the squares of the dimensions of the simple objects, not the sum of the dimensions. And so in the finite group case, the global dimension is just the size of the group. And so in some sense that it's maybe a good notion of the size of the fusion category. But then there are two other ones that I want to talk about as well. You could say that a fusion category is small if it's generated by some object x, so every object lives inside, every object is a sum and some tensor power of x. And that generating object x has small tensor product multiplicities. When you look at x tensor x, it breaks up with a few sum ands, or maybe x tensor x also breaks up with a few sum ands, and so on. And then the final one is that you might think about fusion categories which are generated by an object with small dimension. Okay. So the rest of this talk, I want to just sort of show you what we can do in terms of understanding examples organized along these different measures. So the first two rank in global dimension. I'm not going to talk about very much because I've contributed nothing to the subject, so I just want to quickly tell you what's known. So the small rank, we're really pretty primitive at this point. Osterich has done fusion categories in rank 2 and rank 3, yes, you're pivotal in rank 3, and then just recently Hannah Larsen has done half of the classification of fusion categories Now, mostly throughout this talk, I never care about gradients, I'm just telling you about fusion categories themselves, but I just want to mention that there are often stronger classification results once you've seen gradients. There's a fantastic theorem just recently proved that if you're looking at modular categories, they're only finite remaining in each rank, which was conjectured for a long time. Now we know it. And in terms of concrete examples, in the modular case, we know everything up to rank 5, we know all the weakly integral things up to rank 6, and all the integral things up to rank 7. I'll say it again, what weakly integral are, but if you might remember those in some history. Okay. The other thing that I want to mention about the small rank case are these near group categories. So the first class of near group categories are ones where there's a finite group worth of invertible objects, objects of dimension 1, and then just one additional object in the fusion category. Now, these sort of categories, Izumi and separately Evans and Gannon, have studied this, and they've shown quite a bit. So first of all, if you look at the tensor square of x, well, that has to decompose as some number of copies of x itself, and then the sum of the group of the group elements, and they can show that that coefficient n there either has to be one less than the size of the group or some multiple than the size of the group. Now, at the moment, we know nothing really about the case where n is actually bigger than the size of the group. It's maybe reasonable to conjecture there's nothing there, but I don't think anyone knows how to show that. But then in the smaller cases, in fact, I guess I left it off the slide, but n equals 0 is one case that's in here, and that one's completely understood now. But for n just one smaller than the size of the group, or n equal to the size of the group, we sort of understand the answer in all of these cases. If you told me the group you're interested in, these guys can write down some system of polynomials that is guaranteed to have discretely many solutions, and the fusion categories with that fusion ring can correspond one to one with the roots of those polynomials. So in some sense, that problem is sort of done, understanding those guys, but we don't really understand that. Evans and Gannon looked at a bunch of small groups, and it seems that there tend to be two categories of this form for each small abelian group, but the pattern's a little bit funny, and we don't really know exactly what's going on. Then there's another class of fusion categories, which I'm going to mention later, which is similar to this one in the sense that there aren't many objects besides for a finite group. So here we've got a finite group of invertible objects, and then that many objects again, on which the group is acting freely, so it's just a single orbit of other objects. And he's given a similar sort of classification into it. So if you're really good at solving polynomials, you can understand what categories there are in this form. Okay, so on to the next measure of size and in global dimension. So I want to briefly mention all the many, many results about the integer global dimension case. So here, when the global dimension is an integer and the factorization is easy, then we know quite a lot. So when it's P to the N, PQ, or PQR, then the category is just group theoretical, so root or equivalent to a pointed category, so Beck omega G. When the dimension just has two prime factors, then they're all weakly group theoretical, which basically means that so there's this notion of extending the fusion category by a finite group, and the weakly group theoretic ones are the iterated extensions of the Borean fusion category of vector spaces by a finite group some number of times. And then there are some additional results that rely on having a gradient of some form. So in the modular case, some other factorizations, we know everything is actually group theoretical, and then the result that Sonia talked about on Monday is a graded non-degenerate case with that condition on the dimension you can see that everything is weakly group theoretical. And so the ambitious conjecture that I think everyone is aiming for in that direction is just that integer global dimension is the same as weakly group theoretical. Those fusion categories are sort of solely built out of finite group data, and that's sort of different from the genuine non-group-like fusion categories. Okay, so in the integer global dimension case, we know tons of stuff now, although obviously we'd like to know a lot more. But in the non-integer case, we essentially just know nothing at all. Okay? And I think a nice way to illustrate this is to tell you guys about the finite group game, and then to try and play the fusion category game quickly. So the finite group game is a fun game that get your graduate students to play with each other, or you can play, or something. So we just take turns, and the idea is that on each turn, you name a finite group, and if at any point I can name a finite group that's smaller than a finite group that you've named, then I win. Okay? So let's play this pretty quickly. Okay, but we'll play the fusion category. Okay? So I'll start with vector spaces, the trivial group, the trivial fusion category. So I'm going to tell me the next fusion category. Great. Okay. So I guess I'll say I'll remember the fusion categories and remember that there's one with a non-trivial associated too. So that can be my Grepov Z2 with a non-trivial associated. Does someone else want to play? Grepov Z3. Okay. And then there's a few more things like Grepov Z3. There's things with non-trivial associators. And then what next? What comes after those guys? Yeah, the Fibonacci category, good. People are on their toes. The golden pattern that I said at the beginning just has two objects with dimensions 1 and the golden ratio. The golden ratio squared is 1 plus the golden ratio, so the global dimension is 2 plus the golden ratio, which is 3.5. So, okay? So we've got to say that one. And if we're not doing the unitary case, there's probably something Galois conjugate to that. And then we get to do 4, and there's a bunch of things at 4, the Eisen category as well as things coming from finite groups. And then we go on and on and on. And then at about 7, everyone would lose, because we've got no idea what comes after 7. There start to be more and more non-integer things at about 7, 8, and 9. And we just don't know what's in there, okay? No one's proved any results about fusion categories with small global dimension anyway past about 6. Which is kind of depressing. I mean, if I said that I wanted to understand finite groups, but all of the finite groups I knew sort of smaller than, say, I don't know, S3 or S4 or something, you'd laugh at me. But that's sort of the situation we're in with fusion categories at the moment. The global dimension, we're really incredibly ignorant. So I have a little program that in principle can do this problem, well, at least the Grodin agreements with fusion categories with small global dimension. But it's a stupid program, and it runs far too slow to actually tell you what you're missing. So it would be really nice to make some progress with it. Okay, so I now want to give you some examples of the sorts of theorems one can prove about tensor fusion categories with generated by objects of small multiplicity. So here's a somewhat strange-looking theorem that I guess I proved for the sake of it being useful in classifying small-index subfactors. But I think it's a sort of illustration of the sort of thing that you might read here. So let's suppose we've got some pivotal two category. So we're stepping outside the world of fusion categories. We're allowing, you can phrase this in terms of multi-fusion categories if you want. And let's say you've got some automorphism in this two category, X going from objects A to B. And we need to assume that the two categories are only generated in semi-simple and pivotal in order to be able to make this argument go. And suppose we know a whole lot about the tensor product multiplicities of this object X. So first of all, we can look at X as dual, so that's some one morphism from A to A, and we're saying that splits up as a direct sum of two simple one morphisms, one and Y. So this is what this graph is encoding all of this tensor product multiplicities I'm writing up here. The edges here correspond to tensoring on the right with X, and then tensoring on the right with X dual, and then tensoring on the right with X, and so on. So it tells you if you start at an even depth vertex, the neighbors are what you get by tensoring with X. And if you start at an odd depth vertex, the neighbors are what you get by tensoring on the right with X dual. Okay, so X tensor X dual splits up as 1 plus Y. Y tensor X splits up as X plus Z. Z tensor X dual splits up as Y. And then two things, P and Q. And then, so that's a typo there, that's just meant to be P tensor X is isomorphic to Z tensor B prime up there, and Q tensor X and Z plus Q prime. So we've said a whole lot about how this generating object breaks up in its small tensor powers. Okay, so the thing that you can prove is that there's a dichotomy. When you look at the next step of this principal graph, look at what P prime tensor X dual and Q prime tensor X dual look like. Either they have a common sum and, i.e. this graph comes back together in the next step, maybe there's more stuff as well, but this comes back together. Or this category you're looking at comes from the Hargrove subgraph. It's one particular thing. And the proof of this is a little bit strange. Let me quickly show you roughly what goes on in the proof. Okay, this is just a gap from the previous page. Okay, so first of all, we have these simple one morphisms, P and Q, so they've got dimensions, and so we just need to write down this parameter R, the ratio of their dimensions. Okay. Now, knowing what I told you about the tensor product multiplicities, you can deduce, in fact, that there's an element S in the endomorphisms of S tensor power 4, where I guess really what I mean by S tensor power 4 is X tensor X dual tensor X dual. And you can't compose X with itself, as we've made it be. I don't mean that. And this element S satisfies a whole bunch of relations. It's a lowest weight rotational eigenvector. So if I draw S as this guy with four strings coming in and four strings coming out, first of all, if I rotate it, that's just some multiple of what I started with. Saying that it's the lowest weight means that if I stick a tap on the boundary anywhere around the ear, get it zero. And then it satisfies this quadratic equation relating S squared S. And this particular element that transcends a light. But that's something we can deduce purely from knowing the tensor product multiplicities. Well, if you have that sort of non-degenerate, semi-simple, pivotal two-category that we had in the hypothesis of the theorem, then you actually can show that category has to be embedded in this thing called the graph planar algebra, which is some purely combinatorial gadget that only depends on the tensor product multiplicities and doesn't depend on the category at all, except for its tensor product multiplicities. And this graph planar algebra is essentially, you should think of it as some tensor category whose morphisms are loops drawn on this graph. So some rule for taking loops on this graph and composing them or taking tensor products of them. I'm not going to say exactly what the construction is. But the guarantee is there's some function from this category that is purely combinatorial and builds out of loops on this graph. Okay. So now we use this condition on P prime and Q prime. We notice that if P prime and Q prime, I should say one more thing. This element S, this two morphism in our two category, under this embedding in the graph planar algebra, is sent to some linear combination of loops of length 8 sitting on this graph. Remember, this graph might continue in a really complicated way, but yeah, some huge linear combination of loops on the graph. Okay, but if P prime and Q prime don't join up with this depth, then if you think of loops of length 8 that start here, and at their midpoint, halfway through the loop of length 8, pass through the vertex Q, then they can't have gone around this way, because there wasn't room to get there, there was no connection between P prime and Q prime. So loops of length 8 passing between P and Q have to stay on the piece of the graph that we know all about. Okay, so what we do is we take all those equations for S that we derived up there, and we write those in components, that is, in terms of these loops on the graph. There are many, many equations that those expand out into, and we throw out most of them, the ones that involve any loops that go off the edge of this graph that we know all about. We only look at the subset of equations that are supported here, and you further into a good Grebner basis solver, and you see there are no solutions. Okay? And you don't quite see there are no solutions. You see there are no solutions unless the norm of the whole graph is some particular number, and using that very easily through the view of coming from the Hartree subchapter. Now, this is it's a sort of somewhat brute force proof. We really did it at the end, just throw everything into a Grebner basis solver and have it say there are no solutions, which is a little bit unilluminating. In fact, the referee report for this, the paper that has this result in it, is one of my favorite ones I've received, because it says something like, the result is fine, but the proof is terrible. It's not the author's fault. The proof is just intrinsically terrible. He tried really hard. And the fun thing is that I cheated. I mean, I didn't give the proof in the paper. You just throw it all into a Grebner basis solver and it says there are no solutions, because I felt guilty about relying on a sort of 12-hour Grebner basis computation to say some object doesn't exist. So instead, what I did is, after I knew there were no solutions, I basically asked the computer, try millions of different ways of solving these equations by hand, and then report the shortest one back to me. And then I just wrote that derivation down in the paper. Of course, it's not very cool. Anyway, okay. That was meant to just be an example of a sort of result you can prove. Fusion categories with low multiplicities. Here's another one of a rather different flavor. So suppose that, again, we're in a non-degenerate pivotal category. I guess we don't even need fusion in this theorem. And we've got some object x, so that x tends to x is 1 plus x plus a plus b. So that's actually just like in the Hartree category example. But then we add an extra hypothesis that unfortunately breaks things. We also need for this theorem the hypothesis that x tends to x mapping to x is rotationally invariant. That is, if you look at this map from x tends to x, and you do that, then this is equal to the theory. And that's not true, it turns out, for Rao. Okay. So then, what we can say is that if you give me upper bounds on the dimensions of the invariant spaces of tensor powers, I can identify the category for you. So the relatively easy theorem is that if the invariant vectors in the fifth tensor power of x is at most 10-dimensional, then x is either comes from UQSO3, UQP2, or this ABA category, which is a subcategory of a free product of temporary categories. There's that. And then you sort of work some more and try and prove the next theorem along these lines, and what you find is, well, if the dimension of the 5 boxes is 11, but you have control also of the 6 boxes, and there's at most 39 of them, then the category has to come not exactly from Hartree, but some other fusion category in the Bourgeois equivalence class of Hartree. And we were very pleased with this because it sort of, this discovery came very shortly after the discovery of the Bourgeois equivalence class of Hartree. So it was nice seeing it turning up in a completely different guise. And again, I'm going to just sort of briefly say the idea of the proof here to emphasize that it's not really a very nice proof. It's kind of brute force. But the rough idea is that you take two collections, Ri and Si, of planar trivial graphs with six boundary points. So maybe Ri might start with that guy, and then it might have a hexagon in it, and so on. Okay. So you take two different collections of 40 of these, and then you build the 40 by 40 matrix of their inner products. Okay. So it's some big 40 by 40 matrix whose entries are a little polyhedron, closed planar trivial graphs.
Okay. So
40 is because our hypothesis in the theorem here is that this dimension is at most 39. Yeah. So just a little bit more on that. Okay. So you look at that huge matrix of inner products. So maybe it looks like if you glue this diagram to another hexagon, then you'll get this little hexagonal prism. Okay? So the matrix of inner products are all these little closed trivial graphs. And you realize that you can evaluate all of those entries in the matrix in terms of a few of the structure constants of the category. There's just a small list of parameters, some of the structure constants of the category, and you can evaluate all the entries as rational functions in those. Now, since this space was only 39 dimensional, all of these planar trivial graphs give you invariant vectors, the determinant of this matrix has to vanish, because we just took too many diagrams, and so the determinant, which is some rational function in these structure coefficients, vanishes. And you do this for a few different collections of carefully chosen 40 diagrams, and you find that the common roots of all of these rational functions is a discrete set, and you completely pin down the structure coefficients of the category that you're looking at. And you know what it was, and there are surprisingly few cases, in fact, just the cases in this theorem. Things coming from quantum groups, that free product, and something coming from out. Now,
excuse me, Scott.
Yeah.
But it's all just about the Grothendieck deep ring. So you proved that there's no other Grothendieck deep ring, or you.
This is about the category, yeah. We're identifying exactly those categories that have a Grothendieck deep ring with this property. I mean, these conditions here are all just about the Grothendieck rings, no. But we're identifying the categorifications. No. Okay. So, that's it for the somewhat brutal theorems about fusion categories with objects with small multiplicities. So I just want to conclude by saying a little bit about small and big subfactors. So historically, classification results for small index subfactors have been further ahead, I think, than classification results for fusion categories with a small object. I guess the subject just started earlier, and index for subfactors was always important. So Okuniyanu initially gave the classification of subfactors with index less than 4, Copper with subfactors in index 4, and then Haber showed that it was possible to go above 4, to some number 3 plus square root 2. So, what do classification results for small index subfactors tell us about fusion categories? Well, you can interpret these classification results about subfactors as telling you about unitary pivotal 2 categories that are generated by a small 1 morphism, small dimension 1 morphism, with a different source of entirety. So this is annoying because for fusion categories we want to care about the case where we've got one morphism with the same source of target, but subfactor classifications don't directly say anything about that. Now this gadget, a unitary pivotal two category generated by a one morphism with different source of target, that mouthful is the representation theory of a subfactor, and so by total inverse of the Tanakhian philosophy, a subfactor. This category of representation is not a complete invariant of the subfactor, but sometimes we pretend it is. Okay, so what can you do exactly? Well, any fusion category generated by an object x of dimension d gives you a subfactor of index d squared. Basically, you take your generating object in the fusion category and sort of artificially think of it as a one morphism in a two category between a different source and target. A different way of saying that is you look at the Noether of equivalence from the fusion category itself, and then pick your favorite object. Pick your object X. Well, look at your object X in that new equivalence. Okay, so this is a way of, from a fusion category, giving us a subfactor. But it's worth remembering that this doesn't actually remember everything about the fusion category. It just remembers the adjuvant category, that is, the tensor powers of X tensor X dual and all the operations on those. So it's important to remember that there might be many different fusion categories, which are extensions of a fixed category of a fixed category having that same category as their adjuvant category, but they'll all just give the same subfactor. So we do lose something by going across the subfactor. Okay. So what do we have in terms of classifications of subfactors? So Jones has resolved index for subfactors. First of all, tells you something about the index, that it's either 4 cosine squared pi over n or greater than 4. And that's something by now that's not very exciting. And we all know that the dimensions of objects in fusion categories either look like, in unitary fusion categories at least, look like 2 cosine pi over n, or they're bigger than 2. It's just something about algebraic numbers that gives you that. But but still, the classifications look very different below and above 4. So below 4, there's a complete classification in terms of these ADE subfactors, and it's a similar classification that index exactly 4. Then above 4, there's sort of the terrible subfactors, the non-amenable ones, whose representation theory is trivial. And as category theorists, we have nothing to say about them whatsoever. But as soon as you're outside the non-amenable case, there's actually, again, a discrete spectrum of possible index values. And so, sort of, a whole lot of papers put together give you this classification of subfactors with index between 4 and 5. There are just 10 of them, coming in 5 closely related pairs. There's the 3 that I talked about earlier, hardware, SA, hardware, extended hardware, and then these other 2, 3311 and 2221, which just named after what their principal graphs look like. Let me say something quickly about each of those. So the hardware subfactor, which we've now seen a bunch of times, it turned up in several different classification results, is an instance of one of those near group categories that I talked about at the beginning, one of Izumi's second family of near group categories. So in some sense, we understand it's part of a family that we expect is infinite, and we know how to decide if each given member of that infinite family exists or not.
The second group?
Z13. You can see here that this fusion category here has 3 objects with dimension 1. Just by the graph symmetry, you know that these guys have the same dimension as the trivial object. So there's 3 objects with dimension 1, so it must form a Z13. And then there's 3 other objects in here. And it turns out when you tension with those invertible guys, just rotates those with all 3. So this is an instance of assuming second family of new group fusion guys. So in some sense, hardware now sits in a family and what's going on. The Seda hardware subfactor for a long time was completely mysterious, but just recently, Izumi, along with Grossman and Snyder, did some great stuff where they completely understood the Merida equivalence class of this Seda hardware subfactor. And what they discovered is that sort of way over the fast time in this Merida equivalence class, there was something that unexpectedly looked like something we'd seen before. It's an it's another one of this family that we have utilized in, but now through Z12 plus Z14. So once you realize that you should care about fusion categories only after meter equivalence, a set of hardware again sits in a family of things that we understand pretty well. The extended hardware subfactor is at this point apparently unrelated to anything else in the universe. Say that. The only construction of it is brutal. And then the last two categories, the last two subfactors, are pretty simple. We understand very clearly where they come from. You can look at E6 as a module category over A11, and then look at the trivial object in E6 and look at its internal endomorphisms, and that's a model for the 3311 subfactor. And then the 2221 subfactor, 2221 category is not quite one of these near group ones, but it's an extension by a finite group in a way that we understand people. corollary of that theorem on subfactors with index between 4 and 5, well, it's just this, that if you have an object in a fusion category with dimension between 2 and square root 5, then in fact we know exactly what the dimension is. Just going back here, you look at all of these subfactors, and basically, well, it's a, I guess this is a little bit complicated. The first four here do not arise as the trivial numerical equivalence from a fusion category to itself, but this last one does. And so the only way to get a, if you've got a fusion category of dimension d, the corresponding subfactor of dimension d squared, of these five, only this one can turn out in that way. Okay, so that gives you the corollary about dimensions of objects in fusion categories. It turns out there's actually a purely number theoretic proof of this corollary as well. It doesn't need anything about subfactors. Okay, we have a few more things that we're trying to do at the moment. We know it's index 5 subfactors, they're all basically coming from group theoretic data. We have some classifications of 1 supertransitive subfactors. 1 supertransitive just means that x tends to x dual, has at least 3 summands, unlike in this example I had over here. And these ones, the examples that turn out pretty boring, in the sense they come from quantum groups, except for 2 of them, which are a little bit strange. They look very much, they have the same fusion meaning as some things coming from quantum groups. But they're not graded, they satisfy a grading of the funny phase factors, you do the random massive 3 move, and we don't have a good sense of where those fusion categories come from. We only have a really nasty construction of them at this point. And it would be lovely, I think, to understand if there's some sort of twisting that changes the grading that can get those. And then, outside of the 1 supertransitive case, we're pretty hopeful that we can get past 5 up to 5 1/4, baby steps. But the sad news is that it appears there's nothing new, there's no new subfactors. Okay, so this somehow the summary from all these different attempts at classifying small things is that there are surprisingly few new examples at each step as you go a little bit further. Because I think at every step we really expect just around the corner we're going to start seeing tons and tons of examples. And it's a little hard to know what that means. And it's disappointing. Proving classification results saying that there aren't any of something is a little bit sad. But maybe it makes the few sporadic examples that we have so far even more interesting because they're sitting there by themselves without lots of other stuff around them. On the other hand, it might just be that we're really just looking at the very, very bottom edge of this world of fusion categories, and you shouldn't be so surprised. We haven't seen anything yet. And as I said before, if you only knew about finite groups up to order 12, you wouldn't really know much about finite groups, and we're probably in a very similar situation with fusion categories. So I'll finish with my memory of a quote that something that Terry Gannon once said to me. Maybe fusion categories are like the night sky. And down here at the moment, it looks like it's all just big dark patches in between a few bright stars. But every time we get a new telescope and the ability to zoom in somewhere close, we just see it's full of stuff. There's zillions of stars out there. And we're only just beginning to get a sense of what's there. Great. Thank you. Thank you.
Can you say a word about which of, for example, are solely unitary and which not?
What?
Solely unitary fusion categories. Pseudo-unitary.
Oh, okay. Oh, pseudo-unitary. Yeah, I mean, so all of these examples, I mean, everything that comes from a subfactor is just unitary. Those categories are running lines for a subfactor are automatically unitary. These sort of classification results for subfactors really, although the method of proof barely touches the subfactors somehow and works purely in the representation theory, it really does use unitarity in a quite strong way. And we've tried to sort of rerun the proof here, dropping unitarity, and we can get a little interval above 4, but we can't get even close up to 5 at the moment, dropping the unitarity.
So in terms of two categories, everything you talked about has either one object or two objects. And do you know how much generality is losing? If one cares about the equivalence classes of two categories, instead of considering file address.
Yeah, I mean, I think that we're probably losing lots and lots of generality. I mean, this idea that we should look at, several of these measures of size I was talking about, we're looking at fusion categories generated by a single object with some smallest property, and there's no reason to think that you should only look at fusion categories generated by one object. I think it's just not a fact.
It's more specifically if one, there might be things that have a re-represented with three or more objects that are not equivalent to the thing. I'm just wondering if there's some result that you can always somehow
minimize.
More questions? If not, we start again at 10:40, and let's